If you're tired of bad news, if you need some positivity, if you want to support small businesses, then welcome to Happy, Grateful, Blessed with Kaysville's own mayor, Tammy Tran. Here, you'll get to see the best of humanity from within Utah's hidden gem, Kaysville City. Every month, you'll discover small businesses, hear unique and incredible stories, and understand the difference you make in this wonderful city. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this podcast so that you'll never miss a chance to find a new business to support and learn what makes a city like this one work as well as it does. So join us as we explore Happy, Grateful, Blessed with Tammy Tran.
I'm here today with Representative Carrie Ann Lisenby. Thank you for being here.
Hello. Thank you for having
Hello.
Me.
Hello. I'm sorry. My voice is a little scratchy, so I will try not to be too squeaky and let you do most of the talking.
Okay.
So, Carrie Ann, you represent District 14. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about where District 14, what your district, which cities are in your district.
Sure. So, most of Syracuse, everything north of Gordon. And then when you get into Clearfield, it's most of Clearfield, just around the edges. There are some, for instance, Ariel, DeFay, Representative
She's
Lee,
Representative
Peterson, all take little chunks. And even I think Katie Hall has a couple of precincts maybe, or she might just go over to Sunset. So Clearfield's kind of divided, but I have the majority of it. And then just a little piece of Layton that's down there just west of the freeway.
That's a big area.
Yeah.
Wow. And this is your fourth term? Fourth term, but a lot of people to call and a lot of people to get to know.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit. I wanted to ask you about the session, but let's back up a little bit. This is your fourth term. Why did you decide to run?
That is such a good question. So I served on the city council in Syracuse for a full term, and then I was halfway through my second term when I decided to run for the House. So I was minding my own business before I ran for city council and just kind of doing my thing. And I had a lot of people ask me to run for office. And so I ran and enjoyed it, enjoyed serving. And really, my goal was I want government to be responsive. I want people to feel like they can approach their elected official and receive a response, but also have their elected official be glad that they reached out. And so I've always tried to do that because, you know, when you're just, you know, minding your own business, doing your own thing, paying your bills, getting your groceries, raising your kids, working. Sometimes it can feel like an elected official is very disconnected from you and that their lives or that they're somehow different and not real. And being in elected office, you learn that elected officials are very real. You probably know that, Tammy.
Yes, we are.
And very human.
Mm-hmm,
and,
very human.
But also, I think the majority of people who run for office run because they want to serve and help and defend the principles of good government also. And so those were all my goals when I ran. And so I've tried to just be very responsive to people. And that has been a very rewarding process as I've gotten to know people and meet with people. I early on in my legislative service, a constituent reached out to me and I had never met them before. And they just said, "Hey, I have this issue and I'd really like to discuss it with you." And I had no idea what she was going to talk to me about. But I said, "I have some time tonight. Do you want to meet at the Syracuse Library?" And she lived in Clearfield. And so we met and she talked to me for about 2 hours about a very disturbing case of rape of one of her friends, and that she had been trying to help her and interface with law enforcement. And it ended up being the impetus behind several bills that I ran to fix the process for women who are victims of sexual violence. And one of those bills actually resulted in the capture and identification of two serial rapists in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
So just listening to people and understanding what they're going through, and then how we can maybe change laws to address the situation and make government more responsive and better, especially when it's regards, I've done a lot in the criminal justice space, as you know, and so wanting to make sure that we're holding people accountable, that we are preventing future victims. That's always been my goal, right? And so it's just so important when somebody's brave enough to talk to us that we listen and respond.
It's fascinating. And it's inspiring to hear that someone could approach you and say, this is something that happened, and then you were able to make change that actually resulted in something. You know, we watch national politics and it seems like it's such a mess, but where we can make a difference is where you're serving. And so that's really neat. That's really neat. I was wondering where your passion came from for criminal justice, and I didn't realize that that's probably where it started.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of it did. And, I was appointed to be the judiciary chair after my second year in office and in the legislature. And so that's kind of just where I went down that rabbit hole, so to speak, of the criminal justice space. But actually, I found that a lot of the changes that had happened before I got into office didn't make sense, and they weren't serving either victims or criminals in effective ways so that we could, as a society, hopefully improve, reduce recidivism, move on. And so I just started attending a lot of conferences, and some of the information you get at conferences, you know, isn't helpful, but some of it is. And so just tried to glean all the information I could and have just run criminal justice bills every year since then.
And you've made a huge difference even within our community. We have Davis Tech in our backyard, and I know that you were very instrumental and helpful in making sure that Davis Tech had an opportunity to put a program in to the state prison.
Yes.
That is so successful. I was able to tour the facility earlier this year and get to serve with Davis Tech, and they were singing your praises. Because the programs are so fantastic and they're growing.
Yeah. And we want people to be able to come out of prison. Like, I passed a bill too that required that if an individual is being released from prison or jail, that they would have their ID. You know, there's nonprofits in the community. The LDS Church gives a lot to help people get their IDs, but also we funded and required that the jails and prisons provide those to individuals so that they can go and get a job. So we're providing that education. We're helping them kind of get a step up and say, you know, I can do this. I can be an active member of the community without engaging in criminality, and just hopefully make my life better, make better decisions, and be a happier person.
Well, and for the state prison, I know the recidivism rate has drastically decreased as a result, because people can leave the facility with some skills and confidence.
Yep, and ready to go. And we've also funded a lot of halfway houses where an individual can get out of prison and transition. You know, we don't want to release somebody from prison and have them be homeless. Maybe they've burned up all their connections and they don't have anywhere to go. We want to make sure that they are transitioned into the community in a way that's effective and helpful for them, so they can go out and get a job. They can leave the halfway house during the day to work and come back at night, have some supervision, have some boundaries, and that really helps to transition somebody successfully into the job market and into society from a prison or jail situation.
Absolutely. And I know you've also done great work in terms of communication and outreach for employers, because that's another big hurdle, is finding companies that are willing to employ people and give them the opportunity, having earned it by going through the process of rehabilitation on their end. And there should be opportunities for people.
Absolutely. And, you know, that goes to one of the bills I passed this year, which I've been working on for 3 years. It's a huge bill and a huge lift, and it was on expungements. And
yes.
So expungements help people also to increase their value in the market, to be able to seek better opportunities. And so we had a law. It wasn't working. We have petition-based and auto-expungements, and I'll try not to get too far in the weeds, because I know this is...
No, you can. I think this is fascinating.
Oh, is it? So the auto expungements that were happening, the court would just batch whoever qualified, and it was for misdemeanor offenses. So it was somebody who hadn't committed another crime within a certain period, or somebody who had been accused of a crime but not convicted, those kinds of things. So they would batch them over to BCI, and BCI would just do the expungement. And often people didn't even know that that was happening, or that they were getting their record expunged. And the other issue was that the batching was, right now we have 312,000 backlog in cases.
Really?
At BCI. And more than that for local law enforcement, because local law enforcement was also required to expunge those records for the auto expungement. But they were taking literally like scissors and cutting out names from records, or Sharpies and trying to Sharpie out the name. Time inefficient, right? And so my bill just said, look, we're just going to take local law enforcement out of it, because they were over 500,000 in backlog. And they're wasting time. You know how it is. You're a mayor. You know you want your law enforcement out there enforcing on the streets and making sure that the community is safe, and that, if somebody has an emergency, that law enforcement can be there. We don't need them with scissors and Sharpies in the office, you know, doing things that are very inefficient. And so we took local law enforcement out, but we just said for batching, we're going to push pause. We're going to let BCI catch up, because anybody that's in that backlog knows, like, who knows how long they're going to wait before their case is looked at. And so then we created a process through the courts where anybody who's in that backlog or who wants their misdemeanor expunged through auto expungement can just fill out a little form. It's not a petition. It won't be denied. It's just a form. If you qualify, you give them your name and information about your case, and that gets batched over, and you actually jump to the front of the line over those in the backlog. And the reason is that we found that there's a lot of people in that backlog who are either dead, so they don't care, maybe their families care, so we want to make sure we're still processing those, but also individuals who are incarcerated or under felony supervision were in there for their lower level offenses. And there was a murderer up in Cache County, and it was a very prominent case. Everybody heard about it. This guy raped and he raped and murdered a little girl and left her in the woods and wouldn't tell where she was. And anyway, so he's in prison. Come to find out, his misdemeanor offenses were getting expunged. Not okay. Obviously, we need to make sure that we are maintaining records for individuals who do not qualify. And so I inserted some language in there that said that the courts will have to run through a filter that filters out whether somebody is under felony supervision or is in prison or jail, currently incarcerated. That's really important, so they're making sure we're maintaining those records in a correct manner. But anyway, so we allowed people to jump to the front of the line through a form. And then eventually that will come back online. And then we also created a waiver process. Sorry, I feel like I'm losing my voice. You know, I'm not used to talking this much, apparently. But for the petition base, which are the felony level expungements, we created a process for individuals through the court waiver process, which already existed, to be able to get a waiver through BCI, so that their fees at BCI would also be waived if they qualify, if they can't afford it. And so, you know, there was a proposal a couple of years ago to just make it free and to take away all the fees. But you and I both know what happens. That's shifted to the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And the taxpayers already pay a heavy burden for the criminal justice system. They shouldn't be required to pay everything. And individuals need to pay their fair share if they can afford it. And so I pushed back on that, was able to defeat the proposal a couple of years in a row, and then came back with this solution, which is, I think, a very generous solution to the problem. I know that there will continue to be. There was even a proposal this year that I was able to defeat, where a nonprofit that serves individuals who receive expungements is run by a lady who, you know, she used to work as a county prosecutor. She found this loophole and kind of went and started her own company, started making a lot of money charging people to help them with their expungements. But then she wants the state to come in and make it free. And I said, it's already free if you provide the service for free to individuals in the community. And I'm okay with that, right? Mm-hmm. If they qualify for a means-tested pro bono legal service, then they can get their fees waived. But we're not going to do that for people who are making a profit in the community. And so we'll just continue to be vigilant and kind of stand between some of the bad proposals, but also make sure that we're forwarding really good and reasonable proposals to make sure that people can transition from criminal behavior and incarceration into full-time employment and a productive life.
I love the fact that you looked at a process, identified inefficiencies, and we're able to go in and make a difference. Because, you know, the biggest complaint that we hear after we watch television and the news is that nothing gets done and it's just so inefficient. And every conversation costs more money.
Yeah.
But this is a great, great work that you're doing.
Thank you.
In terms of making things more efficient, actually helping people, and checking to make sure loopholes, you know, are being noticed.
Yeah.
So that people aren't benefiting in a way that they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And it's really helping the people that need to be helped. As far as serving on the Judicial Committee, is that something when you were a new legislator that you volunteered for, or were you assigned it?
That's a really good question. So there's this process where each new legislator, and then at the beginning of a new term, every legislator, even incumbents, we'll fill out a form and say, oh, I'd really like to serve on these committees, or I wouldn't like to serve on these. And from the very beginning, I decided that my interests were so broad that I didn't want to choose one or two committees, that I would just leave it up to leadership, who knew me well already. That was Brad, and I'd worked with Brad at the city council level, and he was in leadership. He was speaker pretty soon. I served under Greg Hughes and then Brad, but I also knew Greg. And so I just said, hey, look, you guys know what I'm good at. You know where I'm at. Put me where you need me, and I'm going to be flexible. And so I didn't ask for any, I've never asked for a committee assignment, which is unusual in the House and Senate. And it has been a very interesting roller coaster sometimes, right? But also just super interesting because I've been able to serve on a broad number of committees. I've always served on judiciary. There's never been a year I haven't served on judiciary, but I've been able to serve on law enforcement, health and human services. I've served on revenue and taxation. I've served on economic development. And then I've served on a couple of appropriations committees, education for the first, I think, three terms I served. And then now, excuse me, I'm serving on law enforcement, criminal justice. And also, obviously, now I'm serving on the Legislative Management Committee and the Executive Appropriations Committee because I'm in leadership. So I've been able to kind of wrap my head around a lot of the budgets. And that's been really helpful because budgets and policy, we kind of have two different tracks, but they often commingle, and it's really important to be able to understand both, because I could run a bill that costs $2 million, and if I don't understand the budgetary process, then I'm not going to be able to understand how to get that funded or how to reduce the requirement for funding. And that's something I'm kind of famous for in the House, is I often challenge my fiscal note bills. So bills that will have kind of a high fiscal note, I will go back and challenge, talk to the analysts, talk to the stakeholders. And I've been able to get bills that were tens of millions of dollars in fiscal note down to zero without changing the policy significantly. So saving the taxpayers a ton of money. And obviously that's not something that I put on a flyer or, you know, but it's...
But you should. I mean, that's why you're there.
It's interesting, right? Yeah,
yes,
just
great.
Make sure that we're doing the work and saving the taxpayers all the money we can, but making sure that we get good policy across the finish line.
So just for those that don't maybe understand, when you run a bill, I know that there should be a fiscal note attached to it in order for it to successfully move forward. Does a different committee assign that that dollar amount to the bill?
So it's the fiscal analyst's office will look at the policy. He'll reach out to all the stakeholders that it affects, and the stakeholders will respond with what they think the impact will be financially on them. And that's where the fiscal note comes from. And most of the time, for me at least, my bills are usually zero fiscal note. But sometimes they do have a cost associated with them, and sometimes it's very reasonable, and I don't challenge it. Other times, like for instance, on my expungement bill this year, there was a pretty hefty fiscal note on it when I started out, and I brought all the stakeholders into a meeting along with a fiscal analyst, and we sat around a table and we hashed it out until we had lowered it $250,000. So saved about 2/3 of the cost of that fiscal note just in having the discussion and challenging, you know, is this really necessary? Do you really need this many FTEs or this many? Do you know what I mean?
Okay, I understand. I'm starting to pay more attention. I hadn't really in previous years, but we've been up at the Hill a lot just for various bills for the city. And I was trying to wrap my head around the fiscal note, the bill, how it all works together. As a community or as a city council member, I applaud you for going to the legislature and serving there. I think it's so helpful when we have municipal servants, public servants, work in the state at the state level, because you understand what you're doing truly affects us.
That's right.
And you understand how it affects us as cities.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just an added bonus when we have that happen. And so thank you for doing that.
And it's so great to hear from you and from Clearfield Mayor, Clearfield City Council members, Syracuse Mayor, Syracuse City Council members. I'll get texts during the session, hey, this bill, right? And you texted me this session. And I love that because it put something on my radar that maybe I hadn't thought of. And I keep this, I know we're not on video, but I keep this tracking sheet that I've shared with most of my colleagues now, but it has all the bills. And then it has all the stakeholder positions over here. And then it has notes.
Awesome.
And so, like, if somebody contacts me about a bill, I put it in the notes so that I understand, like, okay, when I'm voting, I can look across and see everybody's position and if I've been contacted on this bill. And it helps
that
me
is
just
impressive.
Organize in my own brain and space kind of where everything is at with a certain policy. And so I love when people contact me because then I can have something on my radar that maybe I might have missed.
Well, and you were so responsive. I'm not even in your district as a constituent, but still had an opinion on something, and you're always responsive. So thank you for that.
Happy to do it.
It's just really helpful to know because you said, you know, sometimes we can feel so removed. I forget that coming into a city council meeting can be intimidating because I've been in so many meetings, but I went to a Davis School Board meeting. And I spoke, and I thought, wow, this is weird to be on this side of the table. And it is intimidating.
Yeah.
And the higher up you go, I know that the intimidation level increases, and the feeling that it's, you know, us versus them increases.
Yeah.
And so I just appreciate the fact that you are so willing to be approached and have conversations and responsive.
And you too. It takes all of us working together so that we can build that trust. You know, there's been recent polls that show that trust in government is at an all-time low. And I think often you probably see this, but people conflate federal level government with state and local. And we can often be the victims of a lot of ire when we don't necessarily deserve it or that's not in our jurisdiction. And when I was on the city council, I got lots of emails about federal issues, right? I'm sure you
do too.
So I think it's just helpful as we all work together to help restore people's trust in, and obviously we want people to remain vigilant and active and informed, and we can help them be better informed, obviously if they're asking a question outside of a jurisdiction. So I'll often just respond with, here's the contact information for all of your federal delegation, like reach out, and so that's always helpful because then people have a place to direct their concern, but it's, especially if I can't do anything about it, it doesn't end with me. So.
Well, and it's really nice to be able to just have that information and not just say, yep, well, that's your state, that's a federal, you need to approach them. I appreciate the fact that you're so willing to be engaged and really impressed with your path to leadership. You started out on city council. Prior to that, you were a business owner. Right now, you're in leadership. So you're the majority whip, which means that it's your job to whip votes, right? So you get to go and work with your House members and get support rallied. And that's a big job.
It is.
And you're in leadership, which is really, it's special and rare to be able to have the opportunity to do that. There's an increased specialness about it, and because you're one of 14 women that are serving in the House. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Do you know, it is such an interesting process because I think it's sometimes difficult to be a woman in office, and our paths are often different in the way that we arrive at elected office. And there's a small study that was done, and it showed that a woman needs to feel 90% competent to run for office, but a man only needs to feel 10% competent to run for office. And whenever I tell that story to groups of men and women, the men laugh and say, oh yeah, that's totally true. And the women are shaking their heads as well and saying, yes, yes, that's true. And so it's interesting as we engage in elected bodies with men and with women, trying to get to the best solution, and the different ways that women and men think about issues is super interesting to me. So one thing that Brad Wilson, Speaker Wilson, did when he was speaker that I thought was really amazing and could be helpful for other elected bodies to do is he actually pulled me aside, and this was back when I was not in leadership, and he said, hey, will you lead out and just kind of gather the Republican women and see if you can come up with Republican policy solutions to the issues that are usually owned by the Democrats. And I thought that was really brilliant. So we set up a meeting. We all gathered around a table of one of our colleagues, and we talked about the issues that the Democrats generally own and what we could do in those spaces. And we have successfully taken over several of their key spaces that they would often just own with conservative policy solutions that our colleagues could feel comfortable voting for, but that also materially solved issues that were in the community, but just in a way that was more market-driven or conservative in approach. And so that was really amazing. And out of that, when I first was elected to the House, there were only six women in the body. And we had talked about, wouldn't it be great if we could start a PAC and encourage people to run for office and get in that pipeline that are conservative women? And so when Speaker asked me to do this, that was one of the things that we did, was we created the Republican Women Lead PAC, and so grateful for your help on that PAC. And we pulled in all the elected women who are serving in Utah. And we also have been very successful at getting more women in the pipeline, more conservative Republican women in the pipeline, through helping them with campaign training and funding as they are thinking about running at the local race, the school board race, and even at the legislative race. So it's been amazing. That process is great. And I spread that process around. In fact, I was just at a conference in Germany with members of parliament from Germany and from Canada. And I said, here's how we did it in America. And their campaign finance is very different in different countries, but it's still a viable option within their framework to get more conservative women involved. So
that's really neat that you're in Germany. Speaking about that, Republican Women Lead, such a blessing for me. When I was running for city council, super nervous and never done anything like it before. And just knowing that I had the support of an organization gave me such great confidence, as well as the money that was contributed to my campaign. But even more than the money, it was the confidence that I had someone behind me, and I didn't feel like I was doing it alone. And it gave me credibility, and it made me feel so much better being able to speak to people, thinking, okay, this organization supports me. They think I'm a good candidate. I think I'm a good candidate. I can do this, because it's such an intimidating process. And again, helped me again with my mayoral race. And so it's so important for women to have a voice and to be present at the table. And I appreciate the women that have come before me and the women that will come after me. because it's really neat. My favorite thing to do as mayor is having mayor lunches with the students. They come to City Hall, they get a piece of pizza, they get so excited. This last week, we had a mayor lunch, and this little boy said, "You're a girl." And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Girls can't be mayors." And his principal kept saying, "We've had this conversation. He's having a hard time just really, really embracing this concept." And it was so cute. It was so adorable because he didn't realize it was possible. And I spoke at a school, and this little girl came up to me and she said, "Women rock." And it's just so cute to see that children are responding to this. The fact that we can all have a seat at the table and we can be a role model and an opportunity for someone else to realize that they can make a difference.
I love that.
And it's so neat. So I appreciate everything that you're doing to represent the county, your constituents, me as a mayor who's not even in your constituency, but part of your county and part of your state, because you're doing such fantastic work.
Oh, thank you.
Carrie-Anne, I appreciate you being here. I wanted to ask you one last question.
Okay.
And that was just, your inspiration for work that you do, because I realize you sit on specific committees and they're focused on certain things, but you probably have a lot of opportunities to say, "No, that's not something that I'm interested in doing." How do you make the decision about whether or not to run a bill?
Oh, that's a great question. So on the wall in my office is a painting that I bought when I first ran for elected office, and it has a big American flag that has some little tatters in it, and there's a woman who's sewing it up, and she is surrounded by a member of the military, an older man who is teaching a child, and so it's just this kind of symbolic representation of what we all do to preserve the great place that America is and the land of hope and freedom that it is. And so my inspiration really just is maintaining and I guess I would say elevating the conversation about how America and the founding principles of America are the last best hope on earth. In the language of Reagan, and that we need to all be happy warriors, in another Reagan quote, in trying to spread those principles of freedom and hard work and integrity and caring about each other and lifting our communities and being willing to sacrifice and engage. And so that really inspires me. And so one thing, if you've known me long, that you will find, I have a hard time saying no, and that's just a personal fault of my own that I've had to work on, because obviously there isn't enough time to say yes to everything, but I just try to filter things through that filter of, will this elevate and make America even better than it is? And we all do that at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level. And I think we have good representation at every level in Utah that really does try to defend those principles and make America better.
Representative Lisenby, thank you for your service. So grateful that you're there for us.
You too.
Thanks for doing a great job.
And thanks for doing this. This is amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
To all my podcast listeners, thank you for listening. I really appreciate your feedback and your support. Please leave comments and please leave suggestions for future guests. And most importantly, subscribe. Thank you.